And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis, a sampling of the news desserts of the week. We're talking this morning, the last in our series of discussions about Supreme Court cases, recent, compelling, important. Right before the break, we were talking about everything from religion to abortion to guns and many other issues. And just as we were going from the first hour to the second hour, I was talking about this case called Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. This case in which the Supreme Court, after finding previously that much of Oklahoma falls within an Indian reservation, very recently the court rules that state authorities can in fact prosecute non-Indians who commit crimes against Indians on those very reservations. Justice Gorsuch joining the liberal bloc of the Supreme Court in a 5-4 in dissent, but a 5-4 ruling by the majority that permits prosecutions of non-Indians on Indian lands for those kinds of offenses. And so, once again, Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. We are taking your phone calls this morning, and we've got a number of you. Thank you for your time and waiting for our discussion this morning. Let's first go to Dick from Madison. Dick, good morning to you. What's your comment or thought?
Well, it's a little off the topic. It's about yesterday's testimony from the White House legal counsel.
All right.
Was that a one and done, or I got a question in that, you know how the previous gal came on, Hutchinson?
Yes.
After she had done this same type of testimony, and it really buttressed the whole thing to see her live. I guess what I'm asking, this guy spoke to them for over 7 hours yesterday. I think he's probably got some interesting stuff to see that maybe should be seen the same way we saw Hutchinson, or was that just a one and done?
No, good. Appreciate your comment. And actually, we're going to be chatting a lot more about that throughout this coming week. I'm going to be back on Tuesday to stand in for Mike and Dom. We're chatting about that because, obviously, the January 6th committee meeting at least twice this coming week, including about 9 o'clock on Tuesday and then some primetime program on Thursday. You're talking about Pat Cipollone, who used to be the White House counsel under the Trump administration. He did appear yesterday behind closed doors. On the record, we're taking this transcript, testimony before the committee, playing the fact that he's talking for 8 hours means that he is talking. He's giving them some information, not invoking privileges, not in any way stopping the conversation from going forward. Fully anticipate that sometime very soon we will see the results of that interview, perhaps as soon as this week. Certainly a major event in the committee's review of what happened on January 6th. Appreciate very much the call, Dick, this morning. Let's also then talk with Joe. Joe, you're also from Madison. Glad to chat with you again this morning.
Oh, I'm very interested in your response to the issue of a coach going for prayer at the 50-yard line on school property, and that the court has ruled, Supreme Court has ruled, this exercise of religious freedom under First Amendment holds in both, as you use the language, in school and outside of school. And I'm really curious about how you see this proceeding when it is religions who are not Christian. I just want to give you a couple examples and hear what your reaction might be to that. Let's take the case of Native Americans, the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe Nation in northern Wisconsin. If they choose to have prayer that is of drumming circle and the use of tobacco, which is very important in their religion, can we envision a case in which the coach there is able to use those two items as part of his prayer in leading his students? And what would be the reaction of those parents of Christian children, Jewish children, atheist children to that? Or let's take another. There's an increase in the U.S. military of service people who are claiming membership legitimately in the Norse religions. And, you know, based on the old Vikings, there's a big interest in that. And indeed, in Arlington Cemetery, those service members who have died can claim to have the symbol of the hammer of Thor on their gravestone. The U.S. government realizes this is a real religion. So if we have an ex-service member who is a football coach in, let's say, Antigo, Wisconsin, who wants to offer the prayers of his religion, which is the Norse religion, how does that go? How does that go in terms of other children who are around them who don't follow the Norse religion or who don't follow the Native American religion? I would love to hear how this is going to play out in modern life.
Joe, as always, your thoughts insightful and incisive. This is a great challenge going forward, right? And as I said before the break, I think most people look at Bremerton as being, if not a break, it certainly is a drifting from this previous clear delineation between what happens in schools, what happens with school children, not having an endorsement by a school district, in this case understood as a government, an official public entity, not doing that and imposing upon students who may in fact be of diverse religions. That's your point, whether you're a member of the Ojibwe tribe and affiliated in some way with a Norse religious belief. That's the wonder and the joy of America. But it also, the whole concept here is long envisioned that we do not bring those things into classrooms. We do not make them part of our public education. Here, plainly, the Supreme Court is permitting that to go ahead. And I think, Joe, the point of your very good examples, both with respect to Native American tribes, Norse religions, there are many, many others you can think of where it's getting blurred, right? And frankly, I think it's one of those situations where because of the impact of this case, I think legitimately school districts around the country are going to be facing, as the new school year begins, lots of concerns, lots of challenges, lots of issues raised by parents, raised by students who now want to bring prayer back into the schools, advocating, if you will, for their own faith beliefs. That's always been contrary to our national history. And so I think the point that you make here, really more the head-scratching point about where do we go from here, I think the Supreme Court could have gone in an opposite direction. Simply said, you know what, Coach, you can, in fact, you can pray individually. You can't do it with the entire team. You can't do it in this official setting, which is the end of the football game. You can't do it in this very public venue that does partake, if you will, of a classroom, if you will. It's out in the open, I know, but it's a very official institutionalized situation. Simply have the prayer in the privacy of your own home, in the privacy of your own park, and not have that imprimatur of a government entity on that. That was a distinction was always made. Now more and more, as you've indicated, Joe, as the Supreme Court case in Bremerton also reflects, we've got a messy situation. It has been blurred. And your question, which I take will be rhetorical, about what happens next? What about these other religions who also now want to pray, want to exercise their faiths inside a public school, inside a governmental institutions? What do we do with that? And so I appreciate so much the call, the observation, Joe. I think it's right on the money. And finally, we've got Paul also calling in from Madison. Paul, what's your thought or comment this morning? Morning on Morning Cannolis.
Well, I've got a question about our Supreme Court here in Wisconsin.
Okay.
If the left-leaning judge wins in February, I believe the election is, can the gerrymandering issue be brought up again?
And so, Paul, your inquiry is about the upcoming election for the Supreme Court here in the state of Wisconsin. As you know, 7 members of the Supreme Court. We've got a race already underway for that seat. A very important race, undeniably, and I think that's what your question goes to. Your question is whether or not the issue of gerrymandering can be brought up again. The answer is cases are before the Supreme Court when there is, in fact, a challenge in courts. And so if there's a case in controversy, if there is a challenge between two parties, presumably initially beginning at a lower court level, going up to an appeals court, and then ultimately coming up to a Supreme Court, could a court revisit past decisions? Absolutely. Absolutely it could. State Supreme Court can do that. Again, if the case is properly in front of it, if there's been some record, if you will, at the lower court levels, there certainly could be a review, a reconsideration of past cases. We saw that at the United States Supreme Court not too long ago when, as we said at the start of our program this morning, in this case called Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health We saw the reversal of 49 and a half years of precedent. So that principle, the answer to your question is yes, that could happen, requires a case to be before the Supreme Court, whether it's the state of Wisconsin on gerrymandering, other issues before the United States Supreme Court. But court cases always come up and are decided by judges when parties bring them to their attention. So appreciate that comment, that observation about civics in America. Paul, thanks for your call this morning. We're talking again about other Supreme Court cases that have been decided recently by our United States Supreme Court. Let's talk about two more of those that are also significant on its docket. And both of these relevant. A lot of comments this morning and lots of thoughts this morning about religion in America. Joe called in and proposed some concerns, some issues, some challenges as we go forward in the wake of Bremerton and the prayer case. There's another case that's also out there called Nance versus Ward. Nance versus Ward. And again, it kind of fell under the radar, but it falls, again, in the category of what do we do in connection with religion inside our corrections system. Here's how the case comes about. An inmate named Michael Nance is arguing that his constitutional right to be spared from cruel and unusual punishment, which is under the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, would be violated if he were to be put to death by lethal injection. He is on death row, and the plan is to put him to death, to execute him by lethal injection. He maintains that his veins in his body would be compromised by that physically. The law basically is that inmates are often permitted to identify some alternatives, and Mr. Nance proposed a firing squad as a method of terminating his life by the state. Officials in Georgia, where this case comes about, he says, could in fact adopt that as opposed to the injection. And the case in Nance versus Ward was whether or not Nance could sue under the civil rights law. Justice Kagan, writing for the majority, says in fact that he should be able, writing for the dissent rather, says that he should be able to do that. And we'll talk more about that case right after the coming break here on Morning Cannolis, WAUK Radio, The Shaw, in downtown Waukesha, Wisconsin. And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis, sampling the news, desserts of the week. We're chatting this morning, as we have been in previous discussions, about the United States Supreme Court. And right before the break, we're talking about this case called Nance versus Ward. We have a death row inmate in the state of Georgia who is facing the death penalty, and he is challenging the method of his execution. The state is going to put him to death by lethal injection, and he maintains, with some good, credible medical authority, that his veins will be compromised by that. And so instead, he is proposing, as grisly as this once again sounds, that he be executed by firing squad. And the question is whether or not he can sue the state of Georgia under the civil rights laws of our nation to compel the state of Georgia to execute him in the manner of his choosing. Justice Kagan did, in fact, write for the majority, not the dissent, majority in this case, a 5-4 majority. She says the prisoner here is not challenging his death sentence. He is taking the validity of that sentence as a given. He knows he is going to be put to death. She says, and he is providing the state with a veritable blueprint for carrying the death sentence out. If the inmate, she goes on to write, obtains his requested relief, it is because he has persuaded a court the state should readily adopt and pursue his proposal in the manner of his execution. So again, not affirming the rightness or wrongness of the method itself, but affirming the capacity of Mr. Nance to sue in state court in Georgia to compel the corrections officials there to put him to death by the manner of his own selection, and that is firing squad. Again, a dark case factually, but an important case just because it reaffirms the civil rights that all of us have, even to the time of our death. Dissent, Justice Barrett writing on behalf of Justice Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch, says that Mr. Nance should have been required to file a habeas corpus challenge, a different procedural mechanism. She is not happy with the manner in which this case came to the Supreme Court and could not use the civil rights laws because as a practical matter, he was seeking to thwart his execution entirely. She sees this as a way of getting around the execution completely. Goes on to say the court is looking too far down the road. This is Justice Barrett writing for the dissent, suggesting that Georgia's potential adoption of the firing squad was speculation. In my view, she says, the consequences of the relief that a prisoner seeks depends on state law as it currently exists. And therefore, she would go in the opposite direction, not give him this right under the federal civil rights laws to petition in the state court for the manner of his execution. Fascinating and grisly and dark at the same time, but nonetheless a major case in connection with religion, if you will, the manner of his somewhat coming from his own religious beliefs, but certainly his own medical beliefs as well. And as we've seen, a couple of cases here coming out of death row in America. A second case also decided virtually at the same time, departing only partly from the criminal venue and again in the civil arena, the Supreme Court ruling that police officers may not be sued under the same federal civil rights laws for failing to administer the Miranda warnings, the 1966 decision. I suspect many of our listeners, if not all of you, recall this well, the Miranda decision, the kinds of things that a police officer, law enforcement is obliged to tell you at the time of arrest, if in fact any of the statements that follow the providing of those Miranda rights are to be used in court against you. And so in this particular case, coming out of a case called Vega versus Teko, T-E-K-O-H. Mr. Teko was a hospital attendant who was accused of sexually abusing and immobilizing a patient receiving an emergency MRI scan. He was questioned at length by law enforcement by an officer named Carlos Vega, who was a deputy in the Los Angeles Police Department. The two men, during the course of this trial, the factual development of the case differed significantly about the nature of that questioning, exactly what happened, how did this come about. But there was no dispute that Mr. Vega did not give the Miranda warnings to Mr. Teko. Needless to say, the result is that this case comes to the Supreme Court. Mr. Teko does sign a confession admitting to the assault. And a state court judge, lower court, not the Supreme Court, admits that confession into evidence. And in the wake of all of that, in the state court, the jury acquits Mr. Teko, acquits him of the offense conduct, even though the confession that he gave is admitted by the state court judge presiding over that trial. And so Mr. Teko, even though he's been exonerated, he has been found not guilty in the state court, turns around, he dies file a lawsuit against Mr. Vega, the fellow who failed to administer his Miranda rights under the civil rights law. That civil rights law is section 1983. We talk about that a lot in the civil rights venues. And that law allows citizens to sue state officials, including police or other law enforcement folks, over violations of constitutional rights. So the question is that Mr. Teko raises is whether or not this constitutional right, this right that he maintains that he has to be told his Miranda rights and the abridging of it by this law enforcement officer entitles him to damages under the civil rights law. And Justice Alito, writing for the majority in this case, again, coming out of the United States Supreme Court just very recently, says that the remedy for a violation of the Miranda rights was an exclusion of the defendant's statements at their criminal trial. That's the exclusive remedy that's there. He says the decision had not established the sort of constitutional right that could be vindicated by a lawsuit under Section 1983, basically telling Mr. Tecco that he is out of luck, does not have the capacity to sue for what Mr. Tecco perceives to be a violation of his constitutional right. Alito goes on to say, on behalf of the majority, that Miranda rights acknowledges that they have constitutional roots, but he says a violation of Miranda does not necessarily constitute a violation of the Constitution, makes a distinction between those two things. Miranda, he says, rests on a pragmatic judgment about what is needed to stop the violation at trial of the Fifth Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination. That prophylactic purpose, Alito writes, is served by the suppression of a trial of those statements obtained in violation of Miranda. And so again, an affirmation in the civil setting of Miranda as this right that requires suppression, but the Supreme Court saying it doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional right pursuant to which you can sue under Section 1983. Right after the break, we'll talk about Justice Kagan's response to that and then go into our final segment talking about what's next on the Supreme Court docket in its 2022-2023 term, a number of different cases also raising issues important to America. That right after the break here on the Shaw in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM. Acquitted. He is found not guilty before a trial that acquits him of the offense conduct, assault alleged against him. And he turns around and he does, in fact, sue the law enforcement officer who failed to give him his Miranda rights during the course of the investigation of this. And case makes it to the United States Supreme Court on this Section 1983 case that Mr. Tecco has brought. And the United States Supreme Court, by majority, says, nope, you do not have a cause of action under Section 1983. Justice Alito, writing on behalf of the majority, saying that this is not a constitutional right that you have. Rather, it's simply a matter of being vindicated, if you will, in the lower court, a suppression of your admission, of your confession, as the appropriate remedy, does not rise to the level of constitutional dimension. And that's Justice Alito on behalf of the majority. Justice Kagan, joined by the regular group of affiliates that she has, associates on the Supreme Court, says that the Supreme Court has repeatedly, emphatically said that Miranda has established a constitutional right. She says that Justice Alito was just plain wrong on his interpretation of this. That means, in connection with Mr. Tecco's case, that officials violating must be subject to lawsuits under Section 1983. Justice Kagan, again, contrary to what Justice Alito says, goes on to say this. Today, the court strips individuals of the ability to seek a remedy for violations of the right recorded and recognized in our Miranda decision. The majority observes that defendants may still seek the suppression at trial of statements obtained in violation of Miranda's procedures. But sometimes, again, this is Justice Kagan writing in dissent, such a statement will not be suppressed. And sometimes, as a result, a defendant will be wrongly convicted and spend years in prison. He may succeed on appeal or in habeas in getting the conviction reversed, but then, what remedy does he have for all the harm he has suffered? Again, playing out a possible scenario, even in the wake of a conviction, if in fact Miranda was improperly invoked or not invoked at all. And so we've got plainly a disagreement among members of the Supreme Court, as we have in many of these other cases, that in Vega versus Tecco, and a further exposition about the nature of Miranda rights in America in 2022 and beyond. And so that begins to conclude our arc, this five-show arc of Supreme Court cases from this past term. Very much appreciate all of your comments, your questions. You're listening in to our discussion about many, many important things ranging across the political landscape, the geographic landscape, in various areas of our life. We know that the Supreme Court is going to be reconvening again. reconvening again in the first Monday of October. Right now, actually, the term continues. We know Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson sworn in right after Justice Breyer cleaned out his locker and has now moved on to retirement and some other good things in his life. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson joins the court now as the ninth member of the Supreme Court, taking the place of Justice Breyer, and she will be there in early October when the court reconvenes for the 2022-2023 term of the court, including its taking up of a number of important cases yet already identified for consideration by the Supreme Court. So let's talk about some of those. Race-based admissions, it is back. The issue is back once again. Listeners, you may recall that for years, universities, colleges in our nation right here in Wisconsin, throughout the Midwest, have been able to take race into account in their admissions process, their decision-making process about who will be admitted and who will not be. And the Supreme Court has affirmed that in a 2003 decision. Well, the current court in this term agreed to hear in the next term a challenge to that. Specifically admissions practices at Harvard College and also the University of North Carolina. Harvard College, University of North Carolina case will almost certainly bear the names of those universities. A special interest group called Students for Fair Admissions has accused the folks at Harvard of favoring Black and Hispanic applicants over Asian Americans. Okay, so that's the basis for the lawsuit at the lower courts. The president of Harvard has said that eliminating race as a factor in making decisions about who gets in and who does not get in would make it much more challenging for the school to create a diverse student body. That's his response to this allegation by the Students for Fair Admissions about the way in which Harvard is accepting or not accepting students. Similarly, in the North Carolina case, a like statement by the university advocating that in order to establish, to create, to maintain a diverse population of students, we need that capacity to look at race as one of many factors among a group of factors to be taken into account by an admissions team in deciding whether or not a particular student will be admitted. North Carolina case, interesting, the Supreme Court plucked that one up even before a trial judge's decision and brought it to the appellate level. A lot of issues there related, again, to the previous decision, 2003. Will that be overruled? What does that look like? What about race when it comes to admissions in America in 2022, 2023? It's coming back. It's coming back once again. And again, speaking about issues revisited, LGBTQ rights, again, going to be on the docket of the next Supreme Court term. The court's going to hear an appeal from a case that's going to sound awfully familiar, again, coming out of the state of Colorado. This one has to do with an appeal from a website web designer. She provides websites for people who are getting married. And she says she is refusing to create web pages for same-sex couples because she says doing so will be at odds with her faith. And again, she is brought into court. The matter comes to the court on the basis that she is in violation of the Colorado law that prohibits exactly that kind of discrimination against the LGBTQIA community. That sounds an awful lot, does it not, like the 2018 case, this Baker case. You may recall justices sided with the Colorado Baker, not in the substance, but basically returned the case to the Colorado courts on the basis that the administrative process hadn't treated him well, had not given his full day in court, so didn't really decide the case, but sent it back, and a victory at the time for the Colorado Baker, who likewise had refused to bake a cake for a same-sex couple. Well, this time, again, coming out of Colorado, it's a website designer, and her name is Lori Smith, L-O-R-I-E, Smith. She's challenging a state law that prohibits businesses from discriminating on a variety of factors, including sexual orientation, just like the previous case. She lost the case on appeal, and she's arguing the law, the state law, the Colorado law, infringes on her right of free speech because it requires her to communicate messages that, according to her, are at odds with her own faith, not in fact consistent with the kinds of things that she would advocate for under her religion, and kept her from posting a statement that explains her belief on her own website.
She's invoked her religious rights, and the justices have indicated in granting what's called certiorari, that they're going to take up the case of whether or not her free speech rights have been infringed by this Colorado law in the specific circumstances of this matter coming out of Colorado once again, very similar to the 2018 case. We will hear about the butting up of heads, if you will, between LGBTQIA rights, religious liberties, religious rights, that issue back again before the United States Supreme Court. Yet a third case, again, environment. We talked earlier today about this major EPA case in which the Supreme Court said that the president and executive through the EPA does not have the rulemaking authority to address greenhouse gases, and said in cases where the decision by an agency is big, it's large, it's new, it's novel, only the Congress can do that, and therefore rescinded some Obama-era rules that would have placed restrictions in the interest of addressing climate changes. Basically said that the Obama administration could not go ahead with those. Well, we've got another environmental case coming up. It might be going to be the first case argued on October 3rd, Monday, October 3rd. Involves a couple that had put up a 15-year fight, 15 years, to build a house on property that federal regulators say is protected by wetlands. Ruling in their favor could let developers build more houses without having to get these federal permits and maybe give companies more flexibility on where they can dispose of pollutants. A 2006 ruling, way back in 2006, left some ambiguity under the Clean Water Act. The question is whether or not that 2006 ruling should be applied. It has to do with wetlands under the Clean Water Act. Justice Scalia concluded that the law covered wetlands only if they have a continuous surface connection to a river, a lake, or a major waterway. Justice Kennedy at the time said, nope, it applies if, in fact, they have a significant nexus to one of those large bodies of water also out there. And so we're going to take another break here. At Morning Cannolis here. We'll get back to that Supreme Court case and then one final case in our final moments here on Morning Cannolis. This is WAUK Radio, the Shaw in downtown Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM. Taking your calls, 844-967-2789.
Supposed to think.
You think what you want. I don't care.
Fine. So I think.
And we're back for the final moments of our time together this morning. Morning Cannoli is talking about the United States Supreme Court. Right before the break, I was reviewing some of the cases coming up in the next term of the Supreme Court, beginning in October of this year, 2022 to 2023, mentioning this case having to do with whether or not universities and colleges can consider race in making admissions decisions for its incoming classes. A second case coming out of Colorado once again, determining whether religious liberties and religious expression and religious freedoms should in fact overcome the rights of the LGBTQIA community to non-discrimination, having to do with this woman who is providing website designs for marrying couples, her decision not to do so for a same-sex couple. How does that jibe with our general perspective in support of the LGBT community and non-discrimination laws, including that right there in Colorado? And right before the break, talking about a third case also on the docket of the Supreme Court involving once again the environment, this one under the Clean Water Act, and having to do whether the Clean Water Act permits the building of more properties
in protected wetlands. I mentioned right before the break that Antonin Scalia, way back in 2006, had drawn a fairly narrow interpretation of the breadth of that law, saying that it covered only wetlands that have a continuous surface connection to a river, a lake, or a major waterway. Justice Kennedy, obviously on the court at the time, said, no, the standard applies to wetlands with a significant nexus, a connection somehow, to one of those large bodies of water, not a narrow interpretation of the law. The couple in that particular case, that environmental case, is asking the Supreme Court to adopt Scalia's definition, a narrow definition of the Clean Water Act, after an appeals court last year ruled the Clean Water Act governed their property. And so we'll take a look, we'll monitor, we'll hear the oral arguments. Probably that case may be the first one up in October as the new Supreme Court convenes in the fall. Yet one more case coming up also, which we'll chat about. But before we do that, let's take another caller. Kristen, thank you so much for calling in this morning. What's your question or comment here at the WAUK Radio?
Hey, Jim. So I have two questions that are kind of related. One of them is, you know, when are we going to stop with this? Okay, there's a new face on the court, so now we're just going to bring back all the cases that had already been decided, we thought, and just redo this over and over again, you know, when we thought a precedent had been set, and apparently 50 years is not enough for this court to be considered a precedent. So that's the first part. But the second part is with this whole, you know, I don't want to serve some portions of the public. How can they not see the court, the slippery slope here of, okay, you don't have to serve the LGBT community. Then the next person could say, I don't think the races should mix. That's against my religion. So I won't serve anyone but white people. I mean, there's like a million things people could claim as a part of their religion. Where does it all end? I don't understand how the justices could be so stupid.
Where does it all end, Kristen?
That's my question, Jim.
Very good.
How can the justices be so stupid?
Right. And I'm going to leave that portion of it alone and prompt you and others to think about that perhaps offline, Kristen. But appreciate the, again, more than rhetorical observations you're making. The first one, I'll put the lawyer word to this. This is stare decisis, right? Cases have been decided. In case of Roe versus Wade and Dobbs, the decisis, that's the Latin for decided. We've decided these things. We shouldn't always go back and revisit them. And that's your point, Kristen. Courts can, as I said to an earlier caller, they can revisit things if there's a case in controversy that comes up. And certainly there have been situations, we know, the Dred Scott decision a very long time ago in which the Supreme Court basically institutionalized racism. We came back and revisited that, right? And said, no, that's wrong. But you've got to have something of that kind of dimension, right, to go back and revisit these things. And the overall arc of human history, of civil rights history in America has been, as I think your first observation suggests, has been toward increasing rights and increasing the notion that people should have life and liberty and pursuit of happiness. And this notion, again, as you very accurately and articulately described, where, okay, we're not happy with the way the world is. Let's get a new case in here again. And let's go in the opposite direction. Let's reverse things just because we can. It's very troubling. It's very troubling to me. I think it's very troubling to many people, regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on. This notion of settled law and things that should, in fact, be understood, I think your point is very, very well taken, and a concern that's out there beyond just what we're hearing today in these recent cases. As to this other matter that you also raise, again, it's coming up again, as I said. It's the LGBTQIA issue. It has legs beyond, as you just indicated, Kristen, far beyond the Colorado circumstance. And maybe it would have been a good thing if the Supreme Court had, back in 2018, had really wrestled with this decision when it came to the cake baker. Masterpiece Cake Makers was the name of the case back then. They didn't. They kind of dropkicked this and punted on a procedural issue and sent it back for greater development and better treatment of the cake maker himself. So it's back again. And we do have here what seems to be, I don't think it's an irreconcilable situation, but one the Supreme Court's going to have to resolve. And as you said, if it doesn't do it right, if it doesn't do it properly here and acknowledge that there are human beings in America and they have human rights, they have civil rights to enjoy all the liberties of all the rest of us, and regardless of all immutable characteristics, yes, sexual orientation, sexual identity, and race and national origin, disability, ability, familial status, economic status, all those kinds of things, all those immutable characteristics, none of that should be subject to discrimination, right? That's your point. And if, in fact, you open up the door to permit someone to come forward and say, well, my faith, my religion says that I can and should discriminate. I don't like something about who those people are, whether it is their orientation, their gender identity, whether it's about their race, as you said, but it's about their, frankly, another religion, right? Any of those immutable characteristics, those things that make us real and alive. If you do that and you permit religion to basically sanction discrimination here, it may not be the most catastrophic thing in the world. It has to do with a website, but nonetheless, it stands for a larger principle. If you let people do this kind of thing, discriminate based upon, and I would offer, use religion for the purpose of engaging in discriminatory conduct. Your point, Kristen, is where does it stop? Where do we draw that line? And the Supreme Court has this opportunity now, and again, it will be constituted just as it is right now with the 6-3 split, if you will. Sometimes Justice Roberts, again, finds himself in the middle on these things. But in this particular area, in civil rights, certainly voting rights, he's usually sided with the majority of his other Supreme Court justices. Supreme Court has this opportunity now coming up in this term to hear oral argument and to wrestle with this long festering issue. What does religion mean in America? What does the First Amendment mean? And how does that square with, and can it be squared with, LGBTQIA rights and other rights that are out there? My own view, and I think, Kristen, implicit in your comments, is the view that they can be reconciled. There is nothing about this case coming up that the Supreme Court will impose upon Ms. Smith something that requires her to deny her own faith. But she can maintain that view. She can maintain whatever her views are, but still provide services, provide opportunities for all customers of all sexual orientations and gender identities in her professional capacity. Nothing about that is irreconcilable with her maintaining her own faith, but nonetheless following the anti-discrimination laws of Colorado and other places. I think that's how you resolve these kinds of things. It may not be satisfactory. As I said, in connection with the other cases we described this morning, the Supreme Court has traditionally recently sided in favor of religion in this case called Carson versus Macon. Even something as simple as Ramirez versus Collier, the fellow who's on death row right now, and all these other cases involving Boston, the flag, undeniably, the majority has said that religion wins. The Chief Justice has often spoken about not discriminating against religious interests. And so we'll see how that plays out in the coming term. Kristen, very much appreciate your comments and your questions this morning. There is yet another case that's out there on the docket. Very, very briefly, Supreme Court announcing very recently, it's hearing a case that could radically reshape how federal elections are conducted by giving state legislatures independent power. The doctrine is a thing called the Independent State Legislature Doctrine. Case comes out of North Carolina. It has to do with whether or not the state courts, as folks are saying there, were powerless to act under this doctrine, could not, in fact, review challenges to voting practices. As we all know, state voting, state polling, national polling done by state institutions has to do with the authority of state courts to review what's going on in elections coming up in 2022, certainly 2023, 2024, a major elections case also on the docket. And that concludes our arc of consideration of Supreme Court cases, past and continuing and in the future. It has been my great pleasure to be with you in these five arcs. Next week, Next week, we take up a whole new arc of cases that have to do with law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Inviting you to come back. Join us again next week at 9 o'clock at the Shaw here in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM, WAUK Radio. This is Morning Cannolis. I'm Jim Santel. Thank you so much for your time, your interest, your comments, your questions. Be well, be safe, and we'll talk to you again next week.